I'd like you to turn to Luke 17. We were talking about this chapter on Sunday. Just have a couple of leftovers I want to briefly discuss tonight, and then we'll get into chapter 18. First, let's start with chapter 17. We got almost all the way through the chapter, but we were looking at the end section of Luke 17. Particularly the part beginning around verse 22 and going through the end of the chapter, where Jesus is talking about a coming judgment. The language makes that clear enough. He talks about the days of the Son of Man, or the Son of Man in his day, which is very similar to an expression like the day of the Lord that is often used both Old and New Testaments, and very often in the Old Testament used to refer not to the final judgment, but to some future time when God would act in a powerful, obvious, and decisive way. Either sometimes it's actually used of God bringing blessing, but very often of God bringing judgment. The day of the Lord, whether it's against Israel or Judah, or whether it's against Egypt or Babylon or somebody else, real common kind of expression. We're going to see and talk about this more in a couple of weeks when we get to chapter 21, because you have a longer discourse in chapter 21 that kind of parallels Mark chapter 13 and Matthew chapter 24, where Jesus is talking more extensively about some of these things. And we'll talk about some of the question, is Jesus talking exclusively in those passages about the destruction of Jerusalem, or is at least some of what he's talking about pointing to the final judgment? We'll talk about those things when we get to that chapter. I tend to think what he's focused on in chapter 17 is the limited judgment, the more immediate judgment that's coming against Judah and Jerusalem in the lifespan of his own generation. And again, we'll talk about how much of the text relates to that or the final judgment in chapter 21. Want to call your attention to a couple of the things that he says in this section that are the reasons I think that. First of all, he talks about the days of Sodom and Gomorrah and days of Lot, that destruction. He talks about the days of Noah, both familiar judgment incidents from Old Testament scriptures. We kind of left off with this Sunday night, and says basically it's going to be like that, in that people are just going to be going on with their everyday lives, and all of a sudden it's going to come to an end. The world, the circumstances that they knew and were familiar with are going to very suddenly and dramatically change. He says in verse, so it will be just the same on the day that the Son of Man is revealed. Just a quick note about that, verse 30, on the day that the Son of Man is revealed. Paul in 1 Thessalonians does talk about the revealing of Jesus. In fact, Paul uses that language a couple of times, and clearly means the final judgment. But it does, the expression doesn't have to mean that. The context needs to determine it. The expression can mean God revealing himself, or the Son of Man revealing himself by acting in judgment. Again, I tend to think that's what he has in view here. In the next verse, verse 31, on that day the one who is on the housetop and whose goods are in the house must not go down to take them out. Likewise, the one who is in the field must not turn back. When you hear a warning like that, what seems to be the implication of that? Okay. The imperative to run away, and therefore the possibility of escape. And that doesn't seem to square with the day of the final judgment, when the world ends and there is no escape. Jesus appears to be talking about a circumstance from which not only is there a possibility of escape, he's warning the disciples so that they'll be able to escape. When we'll see more details in chapter 21, where he'll specifically talk about when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies. You don't have to interpret that in some figurative way. He's talking about a literal military siege of Jerusalem, and when you see that about to happen, you either leave or you're going to be trapped. And that's is kind of built into the imperative here in verse 31. Remember Lot's wife. Well, Lot and his family were told to flee from Sodom and Gomorrah to avoid the judgment. Lot's wife, remember what happened to her? What did she? Okay, she looked back, which almost assuredly implies a desire to turn back to Sodom. And more importantly, it was in specific violation of what the angels had said. Don't look back. And she perished. And Jesus says, you remember her so that you won't perish. Now, having said that, and there are some other things here that that I think are more suggestive of the destruction of Jerusalem than they are of the final judgment. But having said that, there are some applications to make concerning any judgment of God, including the final judgment. I just want to, before I get too far behind on my PowerPoint here, I'll share with you something Colley Caldwell wrote in his commentary on this passage that I think makes a good application of it. He said, although, obviously Colley takes the view that this particular passage is pointing to the destruction of Jerusalem, and says that although that's the proper interpretation of this text, it is not inappropriate to make application of some parts of it to any judgment, including the final coming of Jesus to judge all mankind. When Christ comes, it will be obvious. Jesus is warning them of a coming judgment that would be unmistakable. Well, when you see four separate legions of Roman armies approaching from north, south, east, and west, basically, north and south anyway, to surround Jerusalem, there wasn't to be any mistake about what was about to happen. Likewise, in the New Testament portrayals of the final judgment, it's not, well, did it happen? I don't know. You know, is it unmistakable? When Christ comes, it will be obvious. All will see him. He will come quickly. His coming will end the everyday activity of human existence. And to think about, let him who is in the house, if you're up on the housetop and you've got goods in the house, don't go out, don't go down to get them. If you're out in the field, don't go back to the house. If we are tied to this life and its things, we'll be destroyed. There's a warning implicit in that. That judgment will be disastrous if we are unprepared. And the apostles, of course, in their preaching, make application of those very ideas as they present the gospel to the world. Again, 1 Thessalonians 4, 2 Thessalonians 1, warning about judgment. So even if, as I believe to be the case, Jesus is not in this text talking about the final judgment, but rather the judgment that's coming in against Jerusalem, that one is still a good model for any judgment of God. And in fact, probably what he does in Matthew chapter 24 in particular is exactly that. He talks about the judgment that's coming in against Jerusalem and uses that as a basis for also talking a little bit about the final judgment, because a lot of the same warnings of needing to be prepared and not get caught off guard apply to both of those things. Again, we'll talk more about that when we get to chapter 21 and we have a longer treatment of some of these issues, and it's a parallel to the texts in Matthew and Mark that talk about those. That'll be in about a week and a half, I think. So we'll just watch for that. That'll be Luke 21. Any questions or comments before we move on to Luke 18? Just wanted to just kind of get us caught up on that. Shane, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people use this in reference to the rapture.
Right.
Days that people are just going to be taken up and look and the person's gone. If the previous passages are concerning possible evasions would seem to mean that, you know, armies may come in, grab some people, and leave others. I mean, is that more likely what he's...
Yeah, and that idea of being, in this passage, that idea of being taken doesn't necessarily mean, you know, snatched up or disappeared. You know, it means one's going to be victimized and the other isn't. One will escape and the other is not. You know, and honestly, from the language, you could make a case, are the people who are taken the ones who are rescued, or are the people taken the ones who are captured and maybe killed? It could, you know, kind of be interpreted either way, you know, based on a military invasion. But yes, you know, what I tell people is it's not that I don't believe in the rapture. I just don't, I don't believe in the premillennial version of the rapture and all the stuff that they say comes after it. You know, Paul talks about our being caught up to meet the Lord in the air in 1 Thessalonians 4. That's not the, you know, the thing that's at issue. But I don't think that's what Jesus has in mind here. All right, chapter 18. Lots of familiar stuff, I think, in chapter 18. So let's talk about that chapter a little bit. Lots of, you know, several important things here in chapter 18. First of all, we have two parables, and they both have something to do with the same thing. What is it?
Prayer.
They both have some connection to prayer, and that's probably why they appear in this immediate connection to one another. The first one, we call it the parable of the importunate widow, not the unfortunate widow, importunate, persistent. We've talked about this a couple of times already along the way in our study in Luke. Now we actually get to look at the parable very briefly. So let me just have somebody read that. Chapter 18, verses 1 through 8. Who's got that? Will, go ahead. By the way, do you think it's good for the disciples to hear a parable about praying and not losing heart right on the heels of Jesus just telling them the days are coming when you're going to long for the days of Son of Man and you won't see them, and there are hard times coming for your nation? Sure, makes sense. Notice that for both of these parables, Luke gives us a setup that says exactly either why Jesus is giving this parable or who it's aimed at. For both of these. And this one, it's so that they ought to pray and not lose heart. So there's this judge who did not fear God and did not respect man. And there's this widow who needs legal protection from her opponent. He doesn't give the specifics, doesn't matter. And for a while he was unwilling, but afterwards said to himself, I'm going to give her what she wants, otherwise by continually coming she will wear me out. We talked about this in connection with the parable of the unrighteous steward a chapter or two ago, that Jesus is using the actions of an unethical person or an unrighteous person to, you know, that can still teach us something. And here it's a built-in contrast. If this unrighteous judge is willing to give this widow what she wants because she keeps asking and keeps asking and keeps asking, even though he doesn't really want to do it, then verse 7, will not God bring about justice for his elect who cry to him day and night, and will he delay long over them? The contrast is God wants to bring about justice for his chosen people. He wants to bless them and do what is good for them. unlike the unrighteous judge. If that fellow will give in because of the persistent asking, how much more will God respond to our persistent asking, who wants what is best for us? He will bring justice. Will he delay long over them? I tell you, he will bring about justice for them quickly. But then he adds, however, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth? He's given his disciples these warnings and encouragements. When this judgment comes, will they be prepared for it? Will they stand the test? They will if they are persistent in praying, like he's teaching them to be. All right? Thoughts about that? Pretty simple parable. Not hard to make sense of. Any thoughts, comments? Mike? Yeah. Yeah, very, very good. Yeah. What about second parable? What do we call that one?
Pharisee and the
publican. All right, the Pharisee and the publican, the Pharisee and the tax collector. He also told this parable, verse 9, to some people who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and viewed others with contempt. All right, let me get somebody to read this one, verse 10 down through verse 14. Carrie, go ahead.
I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I possess. And the tax collector, standing afar off, would not so much as raise his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, God be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted.
So how would you characterize the prayer of the Pharisee? Yeah. The starting language tells it all. God, I thank you that I am not like other men. What do you know about the Pharisees? We talked about them already in the Gospel of Luke. Let's be reminded. Who were they? What were they about? Mike?
They were religious. Okay. They were very hypocritical. Jesus called them whitewashed tombs.
Okay. Okay, yeah. To Mike's point, one of the difficulties for students of Bible and Bible history is simply this. In most contemporary historical literature and Jewish literature, the Pharisees are portrayed very positively. And there were a lot of positive things about them. They were religious leaders. They were the most popular sect in Judaism by far. Remember, not most people who were Jewish belonged to any sect, Pharisee, Sadducee, Essene, whatever. Most people were just Jews. But of those sectarian groups, the Pharisees were the largest and the most popular and influential by far. They shaped the way many people thought about the Old Testament scriptures and about their approach to them. The Pharisees were the driving force in most of the synagogues, so they, a lot of influence there. And again, they were generally viewed very positively, which makes Jesus' words about them all the more striking because he almost never says anything positive about them. As a class of people, we encounter and have encountered individual Pharisees who show Jesus hospitality, and we'll encounter others who are trying to do what's right. And of course, that's what Phariseeism was all about, was trying to do what was right. They just had developed kind of a warped sense of what that was, and a self-righteous attitude that, again, verse 9 says, viewed others with contempt. And so Jesus really targets that mindset. A Pharisee and a publican go down to the temple to pray. What do you know about the publicans? Let's be reminded of that.
Viewed as traitors.
Okay, yeah. Just the same way that lots of people loved the Pharisees, they hated the tax collectors. Pretty much everybody hated them. Because they worked for the Roman government, they were viewed as traitors, like Ryan said. They cheated people generally. They got very wealthy by being dishonest and cheating people. All kinds of reasons, all kinds of things. There were rabbinical traditions that told people, you can lie to a tax collector and that's okay because they're cheats. There were many among the Pharisees in particular who would not accept change from a tax collector because the money was considered tainted by having come into contact with them. In many places, a tax collector was not allowed to testify in court because his testimony was considered inherently unreliable. That's how they were viewed. So you see what Jesus is doing in the story. He's taking one person who most Jews would have put on a pedestal and viewed him as a very spiritually minded person. And the other is at the opposite end of the spectrum. Very much like the priest and the Levite and the Samaritan in that story back in chapter 10. The Pharisee prays, God, I thank you that I am not like other people. And he, talks about some of the things other people do. Swindlers, unjust, adulterers, or even like this guy over here. I'm so glad I am not like that guy over there. Not to get preachy, but have you ever caught yourself thinking that? I hope not praying it, but you ever caught yourself thinking that? Boy, you look at the wreck somebody else has made of their, boy, I'm really glad that I'm better than that. Ugh. This parable really, for me, really strikes a nerve. It hits awful close to the bone because I can see myself in the Pharisee. Natural tendencies. He says, look at me. He's like Carrie said, look what I've done. I give tithes of all that I possess. I fast twice a week, verse 12. Shane?
It's almost like he's saying, God, aren't you lucky you have a servant?
Yeah, exactly. And I'll go ahead and tell you this. There have been a couple of times, if I may expand the point just a little bit, there have been a couple of times when I have heard, but been in a congregation and heard, a well-meaning brother lead a prayer that ended up being a collective version of the Pharisees' prayer, thanking God that our congregation is so wonderful and untainted by false doctrine like other congregations are, or by hypocrisy, or praising it for a stand of, and basically a collective pat on the back in the prayer to God. And that always makes me queasy, and I'm done preaching about that now. What about the publican's prayer? What's different about it? The Pharisee, by the way, assumes a customary position in prayer, lifting his eyes up to heaven. We don't necessarily have to read anything prideful into that, because that's a very common way in which people prayed in the ancient times. But what about the publican? He can't even bring himself to do that. Instead, what do we find him doing and saying? Yeah. He just smites himself on the breast and says, God, be merciful to me, the sinner. And verse 14 says, I tell you, this man went to his house justified rather than the other. They both went down to the temple to pray, seeking to be justified. Only one was. Only one came away from the experience made better. Jesus says, for everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but he who humbles himself will be exalted. You find almost exactly those same words back in chapter 14, verse 11, Matthew 23, verse 12. You find very similar words in a couple of other places. This is a point that Jesus and the inspired preachers and writers of the New Testament hammer constantly. That if I am trying to exalt myself in the sight of God, it's going to have the opposite effect. Whereas if I humble myself before God, then I can be justified. I wonder if, I'm sure some Pharisees were listening, because that's who it's targeted to. In this case, Jesus is telling this parable for the benefit of some of the people who are listening. How do you think they felt afterwards? You know, the guy representing me in the story just got bested by a tax collector. Right.
And that's the issue.
That's it. Yeah.
Prayer is a level setting when I go to God as someone who truly is righteous and recognize my own unrighteousness. And if I don't recognize that, then I've missed it. And, you know, I would say that the sinner's prayer is a great prayer to pray. I'm afraid sometimes that's the extent of our prayers. Forgive me if I've sinned. You know, we have this broken language where we say, you know, forgive me if I've sinned. And I'm not, publicly I'll recognize we're not going to detail sin in prayer.
Right.
But in my private life, if the extent of my prayer is forgive me my sins, and I don't get down to detail what's wrong with me, I think I miss it.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right, yeah. One of these men exemplifies the proper attitude toward his own sin and the other doesn't. That's really the point. I'm glad Mike put it that way. It's not the good things the Pharisee did that were the problem. And he didn't need to advertise those things to God. Jesus has made it abundantly clear. God sees those things and he rewards those things. But only one of these men tried to deal with his sin by humbling himself before God. That's where the justification lies. That's the key difference. Speaking of humility, verse 15, they were bringing even their babies to him so that he would touch them. But when the disciples saw it, they began rebuking them. Verse 15 uses the Greek word that is usually translated baby or infant. And then in verses 16 and 17, it uses the more general word paideia, which is child. There's a parallel to this in Matthew 19 and Mark 10 that both use child throughout. So, you know, picture people, and Luke might just be using babies kind of accommodatively, doesn't necessarily mean newborns. Good. But this, from rabbinical literature, seems to have been a pretty common Jewish custom, that parents would bring their children to someone that they recognized as very spiritual, and it usually would have been, maybe one of the priests or one of the Pharisees who was recognized as a rabbi, a teacher, and ask them to bless their children. There's no supernatural kind of thing going on here, and there's no impartation of salvation or anything like that. They're just asking Jesus to lay hands on these children and pray for them, which was, again, in Jewish custom, the way that you symbolically, anyway, imparted blessing to someone. Parents asking for a respected religious leader to pronounce blessing and pray for their children. Sounds like a pretty normal desire. Why do you think the disciples rebuked these people who were bringing their children to Jesus? Okay, yeah. I mean, you can just imagine, the pastor is so busy, he has no time for these trivial matters. Stop bothering him by bringing your children to him. It's just really not hard for me to imagine the kinds of things the disciples may have felt. They're trying to do the right thing. They rebuke these people and go, Jesus is really busy, leave them alone. And Jesus says, permit it. Verse 16, permit the children to come to me. Mark, in his account, even notes that Jesus was irritated by this. That he was, what's the word I'm looking for? Hang on, it's on the next page. I lost it. Anyway, Jesus is, he's perturbed by their trying to tell these parents to keep their children away. He wants them to come to him. Why? And what lesson does he draw from this? Okay. All right. The kingdom belongs to people. Does he mean the kingdom belongs to literal children? Is that the point?
Well, in some cases, it may be true.
Yeah, okay. Indignant, that's the word I was looking for. That's the word Mark uses in chapter 10, verse 4. Jesus is indignant with his disciples when they do this. Took me a minute.
The kingdom certainly belongs to the people that the world would view as outcast or insignificant if you look at the attitudes.
Okay.
And I think there's certain things to be learned from the trust and faith of small children.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's really it. It's the trusting faith and innocent nature, too, of small children that Jesus is recommending. There is what is evidently an earlier episode that the disciples should have remembered. It's recorded in Matthew 18, when the disciples are asking, you know, who's the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? And Jesus calls a child over and says, unless you are converted and become like little children, you will not enter the kingdom. Whoever then humbles himself as this child, he is greatest in the kingdom. So it's not too surprising on this occasion when people were actually bringing their children to be blessed by Jesus, he says to the disciples, people need to be like these children if they're going to be part of the kingdom. The kingdom belongs to such as these. And he actually says, I say to you, whoever does not receive the kingdom of God like a child will not enter it at all. The kingdom is composed of people who are in some ways childlike. We've already talked about trusting faith. What else comes to mind? What childlike qualities are important for a citizen of the kingdom? Okay. Yeah, children are extremely forgiving and pretty good at forgiving and forgetting, much more so than adults. Sure.
They have full dependence on their parents and flock by choosing them, full dependence on God.
Okay. A child, especially a small child, has complete dependence on its parents. And as much as it's capable, is aware of that. You know, think of a 4 or 5 year old. They want some degree of independence, but they know, you know, if they need something, it's going to be mom and dad that's what they, you know, full dependence and reliance on their parents. Jesus says, you need to have that, and I need to have that where God is concerned. What else comes to mind?
Children are innocent. They're innocent.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Lack of manipulativeness, manipulation, guile, prejudice, you know, all kinds of nasty things that sometimes characterize adults. They're just absent in children until those children are around adults long enough to learn them. That's the problem. So in a lot of ways, when Jesus calls on us to be like children, he is calling on us to unlearn a lot of negative behaviors, a lot of sinful behaviors. Let's just call them what they are. You know, and that's another good point. I think the trust aspect is probably the main thrust of what he's getting at, but you know, there are all kinds of other things that might enter our minds.
I think you can tie it back to the two parables he just told.
Okay.
And kids don't generally look down at other kids. And you take a kid to a park and they'll play with every kid out there. They don't care who they are, what they look like. I mean, they'll play with every kid out there. They don't have that I'm better than you kind of look down at them. And you know, he's just told two parables that say these are problems that we as adults have. Mm-hmm.
That's very good. You know, we've talked about how Jesus, you know, doesn't just say things randomly, and how very often in the Gospels things are not recorded randomly. They're recorded in a connection, and that's a good one to point out. Yeah. Okay. The next thing we have in this chapter is a conversation with a man that we have come to call the rich young ruler. We'll just give you a side note. It is because we have three synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, that we call him the rich young ruler. Because all three of them tell us he was rich. That's all Matthew tells us, is that he was rich. That's all Mark tells us. Mark only says he was a rich man. Matthew is the only one that says he was young. Luke is the only one who says he was a ruler. Oh, you put all that together, the rich young ruler. But if we didn't have all three accounts, we would know he was rich, but we might not know anything else. Or we might know he was young and rich, but not that he was a ruler or whatever. So that's part of the beauty of having multiple accounts of these events. But that's really a side note. What is his question to Jesus? Good teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life? Anything wrong with that question? That's a great question. And there doesn't seem, unlike a lot of occasions when Jesus is asked questions, there doesn't seem to be any kind of ulterior motive or attempted entrapment behind this question. He really wants to know. He's asking the right question. He's seeking the right thing. He's got the right attitude. For a ruler to ask Jesus this question could be a little risky as far as his position and prestige is concerned. He's seeking it from the right source. Jesus says, first of all, why do you call me good? No one is good except God alone. Why do you think Jesus answers that way? Is Jesus God? Okay. Maybe that helps us understand the response. It's a way of getting this man to think, are you fully aware of who you are asking this question to? And if you are you prepared to do to follow whatever the answer is? It's a response that is meant to make this man think. And as it turns out, that was very much needed on his part. And, obviously the ultimate thing was really lacking on his part. Jesus says, you know the commandments, rattles off some of them. Do not commit adultery, do not murder, do not steal, do not bear false witness, honor your father and mother. Man says, ask this question, what shall I do to inherit eternal life? This is one of many occasions in the Gospels where Jesus gets asked the question, and basically his response is, what does the Bible say? You know the commandments. And he, again, lists a few of them. The man says, I've done those things from my youth up. I don't think necessarily that he's being like the Pharisee in the parable and bragging about that. He's just stating a fact. I have sought to do what the law says. Jesus says, one thing you still lack, which seems to be Jesus conceding, this man has done all these things from his youth up. But there's one thing in the way that he needs to confront. Maybe he's not fully aware that it's a problem. One thing you still lack. What does Jesus tell him to do? Okay. Sell all that you possess and distribute it to the poor, and you shall have treasure in heaven. And come follow me. That's the one thing he lacks. Why is it that Jesus doesn't tell every disciple, go sell all you have and give it to the poor and come follow me? Wait, Mike and then Chris.
I said that's not everyone's problem.
It's not everyone's problem, Chris?
He knows our hearts.
Okay, all right. This is one of those occasions where obviously Jesus knows what's in the man's heart and mind and goes straight to that. He does that often. And that had to make a tremendous impression on people for Jesus to say something about you that he couldn't possibly have known except for the fact that he could see in your heart. He says, you need to sell all your possessions and give to the poor, and you'll have treasure in heaven. Come follow me. And this makes the man very sad because it's at this point, all three Gospels tell us, he was very rich. Did he have to be sad? Because he was very rich? Okay.
It struck
Okay.
Jesus spoke exactly what the issue was that was holding him back. It demonstrates to the rich order what was important to him.
Okay, yeah.
The riches were important to him.
Okay, yeah. All right. I like what one commentator said, that Jesus did not command all his followers to sell all their possessions. Gives comfort only to the kind of person to whom he would issue that command. Think about that. You know, if I catch myself, boy, I'm glad Jesus didn't tell us all to sell our possessions. Right then and there, I may be putting myself in the camp of the rich young ruler. I'm glad I don't have to part with my stuff. And it's right on the heels of that that Jesus says to him, verse 24, and as the other accounts make it clear, to those standing around, how hard it is for those who are wealthy to enter the kingdom of God. Mark chapter 10, Jesus says, children, how hard it is to enter the kingdom. And in some manuscripts of Mark, it adds this, how hard it is for those who trust in riches to enter the kingdom. It's not just being rich that's the problem. It is trusting in riches that is the problem. And, you know, and I keep saying the problem with that is that being rich so often involves trusting in riches. But then again, you don't have to be rich to trust in riches. There's a lot of people that are consumed with materialism who don't have very much. Jesus says it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of the needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. Just take those words at face value. It's an exaggeration, but it's meant for effect. It's really hard for a rich person to enter the kingdom because riches so readily consume our attention and become our God. And the people respond, those who heard it, then who can be saved? And they probably asked that because, and we talked about this before, a very common Jewish conception was that if you were rich, it must be evidence that you were doing what was right, that you were right in the sight of God. Especially if you were a rich Jew. And God had indeed promised to bless the Jewish people if they would keep his covenant. And so the thinking just kind of went among a lot of folks in the first century. Rich people must, by definition, be righteous people. And Jesus says, just very simply, that's not so. In fact, what he says is riches are one of the biggest hindrances to righteousness. The people, if riches don't, you know, aren't evidence of salvation, then who's going to be saved? And he says, with God, with men this is impossible, but not with God. And yeah, go ahead, Ryan. Sorry. Yeah.
But this guy's heart is trusting in riches, and Jesus says, destroy it. Mm-hmm. You're ever, you know, and I think that's probably instructive for us, whatever our heart is.
Is that not consistent with what Jesus usually does? Whatever is between, whatever is coming between you and God, destroy it. Get rid of it. Throw it out. Cut it off. He uses all those kinds of extreme metaphors. Descriptions to describe that. Whatever it is that's coming between you and God, you get it out of the way. Whatever you have to do. And that's the case with the man here. Jesus is going to speak, we're just going to skip down a couple of verses to verse 31. He took the 12 aside and said to them, behold, we're going up to Jerusalem, and all things that are written in the prophets about the Son of Man will be accomplished. Tell you what, we'll just leave off there. We'll pick up there Sunday morning and talk about that and very quickly about the end of the chapter, and then we'll get into Luke 19 on Sunday. And, oh, we get to meet Zacchaeus on Sunday. That'll be, you know, We've sung about him since we were little kids. Now we get to read and study about him and learn about it. And another parable, and then Jesus will actually arrive at Jerusalem in Luke chapter 19. So we're getting down toward the last week of Jesus' life that is the focus of about the last quarter of the book. So just be ready for that. Thanks for all your comments tonight.